Hello, and welcome to New Books in Sociology. I'm your host, Annie Sipukaya. New Books in Sociology is one of the many channels in the New Books Network, a volunteer-driven project where we interview authors about their new books in different fields. This gives listeners the opportunity to learn about new books and new ideas from the authors themselves, and will hopefully make everyone dash to the bookstore. Today I am going to talk to Betsy Leander Wright, author of Missing Class, Strengthening Social Movement Groups by Seeing Class Cultures, published by Cornell University Press in 2014. Leander Wright is the program director of the nonprofit Class Action, which can be found at classism.org, and she is also the author of Class Matters, Cross-Class Alliance Building for Middle-Class Activists, and co-author of The Color of Wealth, The Story Behind the Racial Wealth Divide. She teaches the sociology of social movements and class and race inequality at Tufts and Boston College, and was the communications director of United for a Fair Economy from 1997 to 2006. Good morning, Betsy.
Good morning, Annie.
So we are talking to you today about your book, Missing Class, Strengthening Social Movement Groups by Seeing Class Cultures. So to begin, could you tell us a little bit about yourself and why you decided to write this book?
Yes. So I've been a longtime activist, mostly for economic justice, and I've just been in a lot of groups, gone to a lot of meetings, all different kinds of, environmental groups and community organizing. And I noticed that every kind of progressive social justice group runs into the same problems, whether, you know, it's low turnout, where is everybody, or conflicts among people within the group. They seem to have really, really different approaches to solving them. And I wondered whether that had something to do with class. So that became my research question, is are there activist class culture differences that explain the different approaches to common activist problems? And I discovered through the research that, yes, in fact, a ton of things correlate with class, and that I think that people working for social justice or in any voluntary group could learn a lot by learning the approaches of class, of activists of classes, not their own. So that's really my mission. It's an academic book, but it's also an activist book, giving people new tools in their toolkit for solving group problems.
Oh, okay. And so, I mean, why is it that you think class is not really, taken into account a lot of times? You hear a lot about race, a lot about gender.
Yeah.
You don't hear a lot about class.
Yeah, I think there's a number of reasons. I think we're, of course, we're in the country here in the U.S. where we have the myth of the classless society and idea that because this is the land of opportunity, we don't have classes here, which, you know, it is just a self-delusion as far as I'm concerned, where we've now slid behind most of the industrialized world and how much mobility there is. Of course, there is some, but it still remains true that our life experiences are dramatically different depending on the class that we're born into. But if you think about, if you walk into a room, you pretty much instantly notice the gender and the race of the people there. And a lot of us have gotten adept at sort of noticing who's talking more and who's talking less. Do we have a, you know, issue of domination by white men or something? Like that? People have become very adept at noticing class and race dynamics. Particularly progressive activists have talked about this a lot. Not that we've solved it, but at least we notice it. And we have some shared vocabulary for bringing up those issues, and there's an entire diversity training industry. You can get help for your group in dealing with race or gender. Class is different. The markers, there are some very obvious class markers, especially at the very, very poverty-stricken end, but often people guess wrong, I discovered, when you ask them what's the class background and the current class of people in your group, I noticed that people actually guess wrong as often as right. And class is a number of interwoven spectrums. You know, it's differences in education, in money, in type of occupation, in status. And those, it can be slippery to talk about. You're like, which one of those are we talking about? And it's not, we don't have clear-cut vocabulary for how you divide the spectrum up. So you just have to start the conversation at a much, much more basic level and say, what is class? What are the class identities? And people to have to take small steps towards claiming a class identity.
So how do you define class, at least in your research?
I put the most emphasis, as I said, I think class is a series of interwoven spectrums. Because I was studying cultural capital, I put the most emphasis on parents' amount of formal education and parents' form of income, source of income, and type of occupation. And then for the informants themselves, I said the same two things: how much formal education and where does their money come from, type of occupation. And then the tiebreakers, I used type of housing, rental, or home ownership, the size of and formality of employer. I used those as tiebreakers in if someone was on the edge between two class categories. So I had a whole rubric for formula for scoring people's survey answers and having that generate class identity labels. And I had testers. I had other people do scoring, and I compared our scores and the places, the people we disagreed about, I threw out or treated as missing data. So the 362 people that ended up as subjects of the study are the ones where, by the formula for calculating class category, I and two other people agreed pretty close to exactly on where they belong. So it was a very complicated process. It was fascinating. I know I'm going into this because I know there are sociologists listening. So it was one of the trickiest parts. I got a lot of expert advice from quantitative sociologists on how to do it. And I feel really confident. Of course, if I had gotten that wrong and hadn't put people into categories by class that meant anything, then the attempts to correlate different things with class would have turned out gibberish. And so one way I can tell that my measure of people's class background and current class are valid measures is that it turned out they correlated with an immense number of things. In fact, a class correlated with more ways of talking, ways of behaving in meetings, opinions, solutions to problems, more than did gender, more than did race, age, movement, tradition, even though these were, for the most part, not named and claimed identities, that people didn't have a self-identified class category. Nevertheless, their class background and their class life experience correlated with how they did just about everything.
So it really is something that's completely missing in our usual analysis of things, where it's correlated with a whole bunch of things and we don't even know
exactly. That's why. So missing class, the title, is for that reason, that I think there's a lot of class dynamics going on in voluntary groups that are not being seen as class or named as class. And just from our entire society, I think there's some important conversations about class that are missing in action. We're overlooking them. I work with a nonprofit, Class Action. The website is classism.org. And that's one of the things that we do, is we give people an opportunity to share their class life stories and put names to that experience, and have some cross-class dialogue, see what similarities and differences we have depending on the class that we grew up in.
You think part of the reason why generally we don't talk about class is that if we start that conversation, it's usually people that are in the sort of academic middle to upper class, and it's going to be seen as kind of elitist and snobbish, like, well, we have different classes or something, whereas something like you're a man, I'm a woman is more
neutral.
Kind of, I guess.
Yeah. So I do think it tends to be people with more formal education. I actually ran those numbers of how often do people say the C word per 10,000 words of speech, and found that it was vastly more common among college-educated activists, ironically, than in comparison with the people who are facing the most hardship based on class. But I don't know if it's a fear of snobbishness. Maybe there is. You might be right that there's a kind of attempt to not be classist by just not mentioning it, by just like we're all Americans or everybody in the society is middle class or something like that. I think it's probably more, I think there's an effect of the whole Cold War anti-communism that you say, like when George W. Bush said this is class warfare when talking about increasing taxes on rich people, which was sort of foolish. It's not really waging war on someone to propose a little more, taxing them a little more when they have plenty. But that sense of like, well, you're getting into dangerous radical ground. You're being, you know, you're being a communist just by mentioning class inequity or that there's something unfair about our system based on class. So I suspect that it dropped out of a lot of people's vocabulary starting in the 50s. Before that, too, the whole Red Scare era.
So in your research, when you divided people up by class, so what kind of I'm not sure how many categories you came up with, but what were some of the sort of main categories?
Well, I started out with a big class divide with that's basically defined by working class and poor people being those with high school education or less, or some kind of vocational training like an associate's degree or an apprenticeship, and wage work or very small businesses that you have to work hands-on or public assistance. So that's one side of the class divide in terms of people's class backgrounds. And the other side is professional middle class, up through upper middle class, owning class, where you've usually gone away to four-year college, your parents have four-year degrees or more, and so do you. Your parents work professional managerial salaried jobs or were professionals, and so are you. That's the two big categories. And then, of course, you can be upwardly mobile or downwardly mobile. So some people are the same as their parents' class. But then upwardly mobile, I like the term straddler, coined by Alibrano and Limbo, for first generation to go to college, first generation to be in a professional managerial job. And then downwardly mobile. Because I was talking about activists, there's actually a whole category less common in the population as a whole of voluntarily downwardly mobile. So people who they and their parents both went to college, but then they've deliberately not followed a career path, but are living at a, you know, working class jobs or even living in poverty off the grid for because of values-based choices. They want to give their time to activism or art. They want to minimize their carbon footprint. And I found that's actually one of my big class categories is voluntarily downwardly mobile, who I mostly found in anarchist groups. They're mostly young white anarchists, but not all. So I have the straddlers, the voluntarily downwardly mobile, the lifelong working class or poor or lower middle class, and the lifelong professional middle class or upper class, upper middle class. So that's the four, in many cases, I'm doing a four-way comparison, like how do people approach getting inactive members to be more active, or how do people approach the issue of diversity in the group or conflicts within the group. I found a difference between professional middle class people, working class people, straddlers, and voluntarily downwardly mobile. In some cases, I needed to really pull out a subset. So within professional middle class, I found that it really mattered which end of that spectrum you were on, that the upper middle class people, second generation to go to elite schools and be in jobs at the top of hierarchies, just were so confident and polished and opinionated, and they just really stood out. They were so different from the lower professionals who were the had also, they and their parents had gone to four-year colleges, but not elite colleges. So they'd been in bigger classrooms and they'd worked jobs that are more in the middle of hierarchies. And they just had dramatically different speech patterns. A lot of looked at how people talked. Right. And so they were just much more, compared to the upper middle class people or to working class experienced activists, they're much more tentative, avoided conflict, spoke more indirectly, doubted their own perceptions and tried to suppress their own emotions much, much more.
And because a lot of the study that you did was based on meetings, correct? Like,
yeah.
You went to meetings and kind of looked at how different people acted and reacted.
Exactly. So, we studied 25 organizations in 5 states and tried to get them as varied as possible within the realm of social justice organizations. And what we would go and observe 1, 2, or in a couple cases, 3 meetings. In most cases, we were able to tape and transcribe the meetings, so we have exact word-for-word transcripts to analyze. We got the exact conversation pattern of who spoke and what they said and for how long. In other cases, we just have notes. And then we would get the meeting participants to fill out a demographic survey that included things about their parents and their own class, as well as race, gender, and religion, and other factors, other identities. And then we offered, so at the bottom of the survey, $25 for an interview. And we aimed for 4 interviews per group. In fact, it ranges from like 2 to 6 or something. But so we interviewed a number of people from each of the groups and asked them things about the meetings that we had observed, as well as what they thought about the group and its problems and solutions to group problems in general. So it was 61 people who were interviewed. So it's not a huge study, but it's big enough that I feel pretty confident that the patterns didn't appear by chance, that when I did qualitative coding on the computer, and when I put on the codes for various kinds of humor and various kinds of attitudes and opinions and group process techniques and so forth, and then ran the reports by class, it was like putting on 3D glasses, that the patterns just popped out, things that I hadn't seen and the other researchers hadn't seen, and it was like, oh, so many things are being, you know, either by the majority class of the group, then it would tend to be a characteristic of the group as a whole, but I found that even when people were quite outnumbered, like the lone working class person in the mostly middle class anti-war group, say, would act in such characteristically working class ways, and the lone upper middle class person in the community organizing or labor group would act in such typically upper middle class ways, that people were carrying their class predispositions in with them. no matter if they were in the majority or outnumbered. So it was really a remarkable process. I found more strong class patterns than I expected to.
And I guess that's not super common in sociology, is it, where you have this kind of obvious finding right in front of you?
Well, there are some other no, it's not. It's every people were like, I heard a lot from other sociologists, first of all, that my research question, that I found, you know, you found a hole, that that there was something that apparently has not been studied. And it's been studied for single groups or single movement traditions, but the activist class cultures, but it's never been studied in a cross-cutting way. So that I had all these, you know, I had labor groups and community organizing groups and anarchist groups, and I had so many different kinds of social justice groups. But then, yeah, the findings were very, very strong, and that's unusual. If you look at it's not inconsistent with the rest of the class culture literature. If you think of the really famous books like Annette Leroux's Unequal Childhoods, where she looked at parenting by class and the kinds of backgrounds that kids have when they come into school, she found this very dramatic two-way class culture difference, where just about everything was being done differently, and it didn't really line up with race, which I also found that upper middle class African Americans, for example, are not doing things as parents, she found it very differently from upper middle class white parents. And similarly, I found that within activists. You know, that book, I think, found a really clear-cut two-way class culture contrast. Michelle Lamont's books found really dramatic differences between men, working class, and upper middle class white and black men in the U.S. and in France. So it's not, there's a wonderful literature about class cultures in general. It's very little of it touches on the progressive social justice world, where things are really different. Whether it's a good thing or a bad thing to be more class privileged. I mean, we have a lot, of course, you see this with politicians in the U.S., that they have to all pretend to have an up-from-the-bootstraps story, even if they don't have one. So it's not unique to activists, but it's more dramatic that you gain movement status by being associated with an oppressed identity, and you privilege is often used as a put-down, as you call someone, oh, white middle class. That's not a descriptive term. That's an insult. So, I think there's some real reasons to understand how class culture differences work. If you're interested in that in general, there's some really good reasons to look at this this sector of voluntary groups and particularly progressive activists.
Well, and you actually talked about a group of people that deliberately pretended to have less class status than they actually do. In these meetings,
It was quite widespread. It was not just the one group, but I wrote an article about that. That's a theme that didn't totally make it into the book. So in Humanity and Society, I have an article called Posing Pretense, and I forget the rest of the title, but it starts with posing and pretense, because I found a lot, like the part of the poor person in community organizing, for example, is played by people of all classes. So one example is I walked into a meeting, a low-income women's meeting, that did really great anti-poverty welfare rights work, and met someone and who said, introduced herself as having been on welfare and talked about the hardships that she had when she was on welfare, which made sense to me because that's the kind of group I was walking into. Then later with her survey and her interview and other people's interviews, so her she grew up upper middle class, actually quite an elite family, and she's like third generation to have a graduate degree. She's worked professional managerial jobs and is married to a professional also. And none of that came out in that initial, in that initial introduction. She wasn't lying. She was telling me about a time when she was a young single mother and had those experiences. But those were the things that sort of gave her credibility in that group. And I think this is really, that's how she presented herself to a stranger, a researcher walking into the meeting. And I think it's really harmful to have so many secrets, the hidden things at the two ends of the class spectrum, that a lot of hardships, people who've gone through bankruptcies or homelessness often habitually, are very careful about who they tell those stories to, which is understandable. And people are often hiding inheritances, trust funds, second homes, et cetera. And I think that if I work from the premise that all class cultures give you strengths, growing up in any class, gives you particular distinct strengths on average. Of course, there's exceptions to everything. And they also predispose us to have certain limitations. And the group will be stronger if it draws on the strengths of all available class cultures, and that you'll be able to do better cross-class alliance building, making coalitions for social justice, if you're aware of the different class cultures and different kinds of groups do things. So to have this fakeness going on is really not helpful to that process. And that's why in class action, we encourage people to take those risks and tell each other things about their real life stories. Once you've done that and you meet in class background caucuses and then have cross-class dialogue, that you're just much more set up. Maybe if you've got voices of people from working class and poor backgrounds or current lives that are being marginalized, whose strengths aren't being recognized as strengths, you can only deal with that and raise up those voices once you know who you're actually talking about. And similarly, there's social capital. People have networks that could be tapped into for the good of the group that vary by class as well as ethnicity, et cetera. And you don't really know to even ask. Like speaking for myself, I used to, I went to Princeton and I used to, if someone asked me where I went to college, I would say New Jersey. Because I just thought, people had a lot of strong reactions to that sound of that Ivy League name. I didn't really want to be seen that way. And so I used to habitually hide that. So now I don't anymore. I say it right out. And, so to say, well, hey, did you, for our current campaign about such and such, like say I was working on the effort to get the minimum wage raised for people who live on tips, that the campaign by the Restaurant Opportunity Center United, someone could say to me, did you know anybody in any big restaurant chains or in that sector who might be influential, or do you know any politicians or anything from who you met at Princeton? You can't really tap people's networks, people's cultural capital, people's cultural competencies if you don't know who they are. And we've just watched that in class action. We've watched this have a kind of a transformative effect to have real reality-based conversations about class.
Do you find that, and did you find in your research, that communication is difficult at times? Because there's, like you said, there's different ways of speaking, the way that the, middle or upper middle class speaks as opposed to how working people speak. You even talk about humor. Right. Humor is different. And so what are some of those differences, and what kind of problems did you see in terms of communication?
Yeah, so in most cases, it wasn't problems where people literally didn't understand each other, but definitely different preferences. Maybe one of the few where I would say, yes, and actually a problem. So the working class activists tend to have more a kind of humor that's more negatively focused. So teasing is just fine. Teasing, I think a lot of working class cultures have teasing as a really positive thing, a sign of familiarity. And within groups, it works to sort of, if someone's fallen down on the job, not coming through on something, you can tease them about it. People have teasing nicknames. And also self-deprecating humor and joking about the weaknesses of the group itself, which is really by far the most common form of humor in working class majority groups. And there's a subset. It's not all professional middle class people, but I think especially white women, like upper middle class white women or white women in helping professions, there's kind of a teasing taboo that you really are not supposed to be negative, that it's associated with bullying. And I saw potentially conflictual situations in groups handled really well through some light teasing, which is a cultural competency that a lot of the working class activists had. I think that it would be really hard. You know, I'm encouraging people to learn from each other's class cultural strengths, but I think for some of those women, it would be really difficult to develop that cultural competency, because there's that, like, if you can't say anything nice, don't say anything at all, that they grew up with. So that's an example where it's an actual culture clash. More, it was just styles of speech and tastes in speech. So there's a really dramatic difference. I think by the second or third generation of college education, speech gets really a little flattened down, that people use many, many more abstract words, and not just the big words that you only learn by going to college, or most people only learn by going to college. It's not just that they, of course, I was studying progressive activists, so there were people who peppered their speech with words like hegemony and imperialism. So it's not just that, you went to college, you got $64,000 words to put in your speech. Even in just ordinary speech, there's a higher percentage for the college-educated activists of just general words like goal, strategy, context, outreach. And entire sentences can go by with no concrete reference to a person, place, event at all. So it's not that the working class activists didn't understand those sentences that were mostly abstractions, but they didn't like them. There were complaints about jargon, feeling of like it's all talk, no action. And the working class activists, their style varied more by ethnicity, national, you know, I had a lot of immigrant activists, national origin, the particular sayings, but to put colorful metaphors and aphorisms into your speech habitually was really common, to tell stories to make points. And if there wasn't a story handy, making up an analogy. Like if you're talking about the best conflict resolution processes, you might say you and I got into an argument. And if you said this, if I said this, so you make up an analogy story. And some of these were quite elaborate and had quite subtle political points. So there, I did not at all, just to dispel some stereotypes, I did not at all discover a more sophisticated thinking among more class privileged activists, or more elaborate political understandings. But in terms of how they were expressed, it was really day and night. And I think that's one of the things, the workshops that I've developed now out of Missing Class, I'm taking on the road and book tour. One of the exercises is to talk of, to create some messaging about a you know, a public issue where you are would want there to be more social justice, using both those speech codes. So depending on who you are and what your speech code is, one part or the other would be a stretch for you, might be a stretch for you. So coming up with something that, yeah, it has a big abstract word that symbolizes the whole issue. Like for environmentalists these days, sustainability is an issue. Or for my nonprofit Class Action, we're trying to promote the idea of classism. So that's an abstract word that we're trying to promote. But rather than just surround that with a lot of other abstract words, in the exercise we'll learn, we'll practice, you know, okay, so what's the human impact? What's a story you can tell about it? What's a definition in plain speech? What's something you can do about it that will have some actual concrete benefit to somebody? So you can come up with messaging that incorporates the strengths of both those class speech codes. And I training for messaging, branding, you know, for media, the advice you get is very similar to the working class speech code. Make it more vivid. And so this is in writing and public speaking. Make it more vivid. Give human examples. You know, in most cases in the book, I see strengths in both or in all the class cultures. And in this case, I do also. But I think by and large, a lot of us who are second generation or more college, we need to add some of those working class speech styles in order to be more effective communicators, not just with working class and audiences, but with all audiences.
Mm-hmm. Did you find that there was kind of the way that there has been research done into how in a classroom, for example, boys tend to be more assertive than girls or boys get called on more than girls? Did you find that there was a difference in assertiveness between, you know, working class people and people in the middle or upper class?
Well, I found some surprising variations there. So some was just what you'd expect, that those highly educated upper middle class people, mm-hmm. gone to elite colleges and worked high up jobs, were very, very assertive, had no problem speaking their minds and arguing for their side. And there was a whole cohort of inexperienced, disempowered working class and poor people. Many of them were women of color, immigrants of color, who were in a group for the first time, who were tended to be very silent non-assertive. So there's a real need for some empowerment, some leadership development. But that then, if you lined everybody up on a class spectrum, right next to each of those groups was someone who was the opposite. So a lot of the working class activists were, in fact, powerhouses. You know, they were experienced. They came from working class cultures where blunt and direct speech was valued. And so some of the most verbally assertive people were working class leaders and experienced activists. And then right next to the upper middle class confident, polished speakers, I think I mentioned the lower professionals were sometimes you really couldn't tell if they were upset about something or if, like, there was what most people got upset about was over-talkers, people who talk too much in groups. That was the pet peeve. And so I could look at how did people of different classes respond when someone was over-talking. So when the lower professionals might say something, especially if they were facilitating the meeting, but it would be so indirect that the over-talker wouldn't know that they were talking about them. So they'd say, Maybe we should get back to our agenda with that upward inflection, question mark. And then when in their interviews, I'd ask them about that, and they'd be like, well, I feel frustrated because the one person's taking up so much space, and I really, I would like to get them to talk less. But, on the other hand, I want this to be a place where everyone's voice is welcome or democratic, and so I don't want to be the heavy and cut them off. And it's back and forth and back and forth, and they shouldn't really, they feel irritated at the overtalker, but they feel like they shouldn't have the emotions that they have. It was really dramatic, and almost no direct confrontation of anybody. So when there was an argument or a conflict came up, those lower professionals and disempowered working class and poor people were usually the silent bystanders. And the other group, besides the upper middle class confident people and the powerhouse working class leaders, there was another group that was actually in some ways the most argumentative, which was a subset of the straddlers that I call the unassimilated straddlers. They were first generation to go to college after a working class childhood, but they had not gone on to pursue a professional career. And a lot of them were sort of had no real accountability to they didn't have their family of origin near them. They didn't have kids in the schools. They didn't have an employer. And they combined that blunt directness and class anger from their working class backgrounds with the tendency to be more ideological and more critical that people seem to gain from going to college. And it wasn't everybody, of course, but a subset of the unassimilated straddlers were just harsh arguers. And just so that's who it would be, is like the combatants would be these confident upper middle class people and these just harsh unassimilated straddlers battling it out, while on the sidelines the lower professionals and disempowered working class and poor people were just sort of watching in horrified silence.
Is this the distinction that you make between rooted versus unrooted activists?
Yeah, that turned out to be so relevant. So in terms of conflict behavior and what happens when somebody does something that really breaches the group norms, or who are the breachers. A lot of I measured everybody's story on a number of indicators of rootedness. So the most rooted were middle-aged labor union members. They had a workplace. They usually had extended family in the area. Of course, they belonged to the union. Those most rooted activists were the least likely to do things that would really upset and horrify other group members. And then, of course, all people who go away to college uproot themselves to some extent. So there is a class correlation with professional middle class people, but even more, I met a lot of voluntarily downwardly mobile activists who were living on the road, going from direct action, and so they had basically no local ties, and in some cases, not even long term ties to their groups. Their groups were ad hoc groups that came together for a particular protest, it seems that. That they, the unassimilated straddlers, and just a bunch of random unrooted people who showed up in every group, were the most likely to do something that other members would find very offensive. So there was all kinds of behavior, public insults and trashing, mismanagement of money, public intoxication. There's just all, but a lot of it was just things within the group. The group would have a norm of how do you handle conflict or what's the group process, and that is unrooted activists that, there weren't very many of them. This wasn't, most people don't do stuff like this, but people who would just flout the the group norms seemingly with impunity. So I thought that was a really interesting finding, and one that cuts across class to some extent.
You work with an organization you talked about a little bit in your book, Class Action. Could you tell us a little bit about that and how that relates to your research?
Yeah, it's really great convergence of my nonprofit work and my academic work. So Class Action is 10 years old this year. We're a national nonprofit, and our mission is to rid the world of classism. We say our vision is a world without classism, and we try to get people to have conversations about social class in our lives, in our organizations, and in the society as a whole. We do workshops, as I mentioned. We have a website, classism.org, and a blog called Classism Exposed. For example, one thing that we do is we work with first-generation college students. We've now had two first-gen summits where college programs to support first-generation students or peer support, peer support groups, because, you know, the vast majority of first-generation college students drop out. Excuse me. So it's really a problem, and a lot. It's not just lacking the money to go to college or the academic preparation, but there's a culture clash that happens where they feel like fish out of water. They get a lot of classism dumped on them for their clothes or the way they speak, or just like they don't know the ropes. So we feel like high schools and colleges should be doing much, much better by these students. So we're having these gatherings. You can see on our website the second annual First Gen Summit just happened recently. So that's the kind of thing that Class Action does. And within Class Action, we have 20 workshop facilitators, and we specialize in different kinds of organizations. So I specialize in social justice organizations. I'm one of a number who do, because we feel like that's a priority constituency, because it's people who are deliberately trying to make things better in their community or in the world. And so if you impact a group like that, you're going to end up having impact much more widely. So I've been tracking this because I've been an activist myself for the last three decades. I've noticed so many class differences. I've noticed so many coalitions break apart along class lines. I did an earlier non-academic book called Class Matters, Cross-Class Alliance Building for Middle-Class Activists. It's kind of a patchwork of how-to tips. I found that I wrote a small essay in that book called Are There Class Cultures?, where I said I thought there were class cultures, and I thought they were very relevant for activists. And that turned out to be the most focused on part of the Class Matters book. That people, I just got such strong reactions of people being enthusiastic and saying, could I elaborate and say more? What are they? People being skeptical or disagreeing and thinking I got the details wrong, asking me whether I could prove it. What are the class culture traits? It just seemed like, wow, there's really a lot there. There's a lot of curiosity. A lot of activists felt like it's intuitively something's right there, but I hadn't really spelled it out. And I already had a master's in sociology, and I thought, wow, that calls for some social science research. So I quit my day job, which was at United for a Fair Economy, and went back to grad school and had some excellent sociologists helping me do this study, and did it as my dissertation, got my PhD, and turned it into this book. So I feel like I really did answer, I can now really answer those questions that people were asking me back in 2005, 2006. Are there activist class cultures? Yes. Can I define exactly what they are? Yes. It's very different from what I hypothesized. So the details did turn out to be wrong. You know, the hypotheses were wrong, but that they're very, very, and I can test them in many cases with statistics that these patterns did not happen by chance. There really are correlations between many, many activist behaviors, attitudes, ways of speaking, ways of solving group problems, and the activist class.
Fantastic. Betsy, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us today about your book.
Oh, it's my pleasure. It seems like such a wonderful kind of show that you're doing. So you're doing a service for all of us sociologists.
You have been listening to an interview with Betsy Leander Wright, author of Missing Class, Strengthening Social Movement Groups by Seeing Class Cultures. This is your hostess, Annie Sibukaya. Thanks for listening to New Books in Sociology.